Ave,
and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Catherine Tempest, reader in Classics and Ancient History at the University of Roehampton. This is episode CLXXXIII, Philippics. As the power struggle in Rome continued and generals waged their war on the battlefield, Cicero took to the floors of the Senate, confronting Antony with the greatest weapon in his arsenal, the spoken word. He called his speeches the Philippics, and they were influential in turning the Senate against Antony. Here's Catherine Tempest.
Broadly speaking, the Philippics are Cicero's contribution to the intense power struggle that took place in the wake of Caesar's assassination. And specifically, they are the written records of the speeches he delivered, whether that was in the Senate, to the people, or in one case, the speech he would like to have delivered, but he didn't get the chance to and wrote it up anyway, condemning Mark Antony, who Cicero believed was the next great threat to Rome. So Cicero saw Mark Antony as an emerging tyrant, a man who, like Caesar before him, was a threat to the kind of freedom that underpinned the Roman thinking about their political constitution, the Republic. It was really in opposition to one-man rule. And this idea of Antony as a threat to liberty also helps explain the title to the collection, Philippici. It doesn't seem to make much sense. Surely they should be the speeches against Antony. But we have 14 speeches that were transmitted as a collection. They're organised chronologically from the start of Cicero's hostility with Antony in September 44 to the triumphant end. He ends on a key point in his struggle in April 43 BC. And as I said, they were referred to and known by ancient sources as Cicero's Philippici. But this name for the collection originated with Cicero, who sort of tested it sort of in a joking fashion on Marcus Brutus, one of the lead assassins. Now, the point was that the Philippics was actually a collection of Greek speeches delivered and published by the Athenian orator Demosthenes when he was leading a similar fight against Philip II of Macedon, the father of Alexander the Great, in the 4th century BC. When I say similar, I mean there are many shared themes, such as liberty versus tyranny, and both sets of speeches create this pervading sense of crisis. But that was enough for Cicero, who always admired and sought to equate his image with that of his model. So Cicero very much wanted to be the Roman Demosthenes, and this is why I say it was probably semi-jokingly that he suggested the name Philippics for his corpus. He matched his fight against Antony to Demosthenes' fight against Philip. Both of them were striving for the liberty of their countries. And when Brutus responded positively, saying that, yes, I agree, they deserve the title, that the name seems to have stuck.
Interesting that he's equated it to that. He's used the term Philippics as a kind of category and almost redefined what the name means. It no longer applies to Philip. It's its own thing now. So conceivably, you know, later on in the imperial age, somebody else could have a similar argument against somebody that they thought was a threat and call it Philippics as well in that sort of way.
Yeah, it sort of transfers the name. I mean, what Cicero was doing here is really unusual, i.e. he's the first Roman to decide to create a corpus of speeches and have them edited as a collection. Now, we don't know much about the editing of the collection of the Philippics, whether it was Cicero that purposefully put them together, but we do have a parallel case where in the wake of his consulship in 63 BC, he decided to create a corpus of 10 speeches called his consular orations. So we know that Cicero often thought about his speeches in a collection, and that's a first for Roman thinking. I would prefer the hypothesis that he deliberately put these out as a collection of Philippics to match Demosthenes. And yes, as you say, symbolically then, Philippics comes to stand for a particular type of freedom, fighting, campaign, an activism that challenges the emerging tyrant and really promotes patriotic liberty.
Mm. Who was his intended audience then by writing this? I guess he's wanting as wide an audience as possible, but he is specifically writing these to be delivered in oration form in the Senate, isn't he?
Well, Cicero typically wrote up his speeches after they had been delivered. So an orator would never read off a set of notes. So you're absolutely right that he's intending this for a wider audience. They capture the essence of what he delivered in the Senate, or in the case of the second Philippic, what he would like to have said in the Senate. And we've also got a couple of speeches in the collection that were delivered to the people. So when he writes these up, they're probably based off notes. His typical practice was to write out the introduction and the conclusion of a speech, and it would be delivered off memory. These speeches are highly polished, highly edited revisions. When he disseminates them, it's to that wider audience of senatorial ruling elite. Now, some of his readers, he wants to promote what he's doing in Rome. So we know, for example, that he sent some of the Philippics to Marcus Brutus, who was campaigning over in the East. So he could show what he is arguing back in the centre of Rome and what political stance he's taking. But there's something going on in the political culture of the Roman Republic at this time, where pamphleteering has become quite an important political activity in its own right. Earlier in his career, Cicero would publish speeches maybe a year or two after the date. So the consular orations that I mentioned, we know that he was building that corpus in 60 BC because he mentions it in a letter to his friend Atticus. But that's 3 years after the event. So what's really interesting about these Philippics is, first of all, he's disseminating them individually, quickly, and firing them off to friends to show what he's doing, but to the wider reading audience of Rome. And this is part of that political culture I'm talking about, this pamphleteering. We know Antony engaged in it as well. And he also supposedly sort of circulated speeches, but there were edicts that were flying around. Brutus and Cassius engage in this kind of publication of edicts. We get open letters all of a sudden. This wasn't something that seems to have happened in Cicero's earlier career. As I said, there was normally a bit of a time lag. And in those days, he wrote his speeches up very often with a view to what a younger reading audience might learn from them. They were models of oratory. Cicero was establishing his reputation as the master orator of Rome. As I mentioned, he wants to be that Roman Demosthenes. But certainly in the period of the Philippics, this writing activity is a crucial part of his political activity.
Okay, so we're not going to go through all the 14 Philippics, but if we could explore some of the highlights. The first Philippic must go a long way to explain the animosity between Cicero and Mark Antony that existed at the time. So what does that tell us then?
Yeah, the first Philippic is a treasure trove of material. It really details all that had gone wrong, in Cicero's opinion, from the Ides of March until the real break between Cicero and Antony, which occurred at the beginning of September 44 BC. So it's a really, really interesting text. Some scholars think it treads a moderate line insofar as it appears to steer Mark Antony and his co-consul Dolabella back to a point of moderate behaviour where a compromise might still be possible. So it tells us a little bit about the situation at September, because Antony might still be manoeuvrable if we accept that it's quite a moderate text. So, for example, it praises Mark Antony for some of his actions in the immediate aftermath of the assassination. Cicero speaks highly of a speech Antony made in the Senate when he agreed to Cicero's amnesty agreement, which had secured some protection for Caesar's assassins. And he warmly approved of Antony's decision to abolish the title of dictator. This was a great move by Antony, and Cicero commends it because it seemed to offer some kind of protection against the type of autocracy that Caesar had wielded. But Cicero is also highly critical of Mark Antony in this speech for other reasons. The key thing that it tells us about is the amnesty agreement and how it was being used, how it was sort of being received. So the agreement is that the assassins won't be punished by law or any other means. So Antony's offered some protection to the assassins. And in return, there are a number of other sort of essentials. For example, Caesar is allowed a burial and a funeral at Rome. This is the occasion that Antony makes great theatre out of to get people on his side and revive the memory of Caesar. But one of the critical things about the amnesty agreement was that it agreed that all of Caesar's acts, that is, the legislation and magisterial appointments he had planned, were still going to be passed. And a large part of the first Philippic is devoted to arguing that Antony is actually somehow betraying Caesar's legacy by disregarding some of Caesar's legislation, or even that he's passing off legislation, pretending that it is Caesar's. So this amnesty agreement was a very delicate balance, and Mark Antony seems to have overstepped the mark and was using the amnesty agreement really to push a lot of his own political concerns through. And this is what Cicero is really objecting against in the first Philippic. So it's not really a full declaration of war on Cicero's part, but it was presenting him as a voice of opposition in the future. So it's really Cicero staking his claim to be the person who is going to call Antony to account. As such, becomes clear at one point in the speech when Cicero says, "If I say anything offensive against his career or character, I shall not object to his becoming my mortal enemy. On the other hand," he says, "if I hold to my invariable practice in public life, that is, if I speak my mind freely on public affairs, in the first place, I beg him not to be angry. But if that plea fails," Cicero continues, "I ask him to be angry with me as a fellow citizen." In other words, Cicero goes on to state explicitly, "Don't let him use arms against me." So it's very much Cicero seeing that he is potentially about to overstep the mark, reminding Antony that this is a personal enmity, that he is going to be a voice of the opposition. He can see where it could potentially lead, but he's also begging Antony not to let arms come into the agenda. It's a really interesting case from that perspective, because it just shows you how delicate that balance was going to be and how important it was going to be to keep that harmony. It looks like for a long time, Antony and Brutus, others, including Cicero, had tried to keep to the amnesty agreement. It had been Cicero that had negotiated it, after all, but it really was falling apart at the seams.
It's a very middle ground, considering how much he's just essentially going to take the gloves off in Philippics 2. We don't have any version of what Antony said here, or any records, or we don't have his speech, his reply, his rebuttal to the Philippics. But do we get a sense at all of the kind of things that he might have said in response or thought about what Cicero had to say?
Antony was absolutely furious with Cicero, and we do get an impression of what his speech contained, because in Cicero's second Philippic, he has to go on the defence. So this had all started when Cicero was due to appear in the Senate on the 1st of September. Antony was putting forward a proposal to add a day in honour of Caesar to all public thanksgivings. And Cicero really didn't want to vote on this. He had a legitimate excuse. He had just spent the summer trying to get over to Athens to visit his son, and he'd been forced to return because of bad weather. And he decided to go back to Rome. And so Cicero had probably only landed in Rome either the day before this Senate meeting or even on the very morning. So he didn't want to vote on honours for Caesar. This was distasteful to him. So he sends his apologies. Yet Antony had taken it as a personal affront. Now, all we know about the first speech that Antony delivered, which is what Cicero replied to in the first Philippic, is that he'd made threats to humiliate Cicero and inflict damage on his houses, you know, send some slaves around. This was particularly bad for Cicero because Cicero's house had actually been destroyed once before by another enemy, and he'd had to have it rebuilt at expense. And it brought back the humiliations of Cicero's exile, the period when Cicero's other enemy, Clodius, had been calling Cicero a tyrant. So Antony threatening to inflict damage on his house is a really pointed sort of reminder of Cicero's failures in his political career. And this seems to be what happens next as well. Cicero tells us that Antony withdrew to one of his villas with a rhetorician and spent weeks composing this reply to Cicero that we don't have. But in his second Philippic, Cicero tells us what that speech contained, largely because he had to defend himself against the accusations. So we've gone from the 1st of September to the 19th of September. And the 19th of September is the date at which Antony sets another Senate meeting, and he wants Cicero present. But Cicero, fearing for his own safety, decides to stay away. By all accounts, we can see that Antony made a number of charges against Cicero. On a personal level, he said that he had broken the bonds of their friendship. They had tried to work politically together in the past and had done each other's favours. This was an important concept in Roman political thinking. This amicitia, the friendship, was about a give and take, and kindness is bestowed and received. And Mark Antony accused Cicero of having betrayed the bonds of that friendship. But it then took a much darker line as he included various other charges against Cicero. He accuses him of instigating the murder of Clodius. He brings back old charges against Cicero's consulship in 63 BC. For Cicero, this had been the highlight in his career, the time at which he had saved Rome from an alleged coup d'etat led by Catiline. Yet his actions in executing some of the conspirators attached to Catiline had provoked a lot of worry at Rome. And he also said that he was the intellectual author, the brains behind the assassination of Caesar as well. So he's really throwing a lot at Cicero to completely rubbish the record of his career and Cicero's reputation. And this is why we know what Antony said, because Cicero was so determined to get his own voice on paper.
That kind of explains why the rest of the Second Philippic is maybe so scathing and thorough in its content. While I'd like to wade through that and hear about that in a little bit, I just wanted to know at this point, the Second Philippic isn't a speech that Cicero delivered, is it? It's one that he wrote and distributed much later, but there was never a Senate version of this.
Correct. This goes back to the point that on the 19th of September, Antony had called a meeting of the Senate, wanted Cicero present, and had delivered a speech against Cicero. But Cicero had stayed away, fearing the worst. I mean, Antony had already threatened to, you know, inflict damage on his house. What else could he do? So what Cicero did was he wrote up the speech that he would have liked to deliver. I'm sure we'd all love to do that, you know, when you've walked away from an argument and realised all the things you wish you had said afterwards. Cicero does this, he puts it on paper. So he invokes the setting of the speech. He imagines that this is the speech he is delivering. He sends it to his friend Atticus, who often works as his publicist and publisher in Rome. And Atticus actually comes back with some revisions to make it better. Cicero sends it back to him. And he specifically says at the end of October in his letter to Atticus, "I don't know when this should see the wider light of day." So we don't know exactly when he put it out, but a strong guess would be sometime between the November and December of that same year. And I make this guess for a couple of reasons. The first is that chronologically, the collection sort of fits neatly with the outbreak of hostilities. By the end of November, Antony had left Rome to take up a position in Gaul. And so with Antony out of Rome, maybe Cicero felt more confident getting those views out on paper. Certainly by the third Philippic, which was delivered on the 20th of December, Cicero is starting to make his hostilities very clear, and the final break starts happening around then. Initially, Cicero had in mind not to rock the boat until the 1st of January 43 BC because new consuls, Hirtius and Pansa, were going to come into play. So Antony wouldn't be the consul of Rome anymore and he could start his attack proper. So it was probably published sometime around that November, December, maybe going into the January of 43 BC. But you're absolutely right. It's fictional. He didn't deliver it. But it's a speech he would have delivered had he attended the meeting of the Senate on the 19th of September.
Let's talk about what it tells us about Antony, or what Cicero tells us about Antony in his version that we've got here. There are also, I should say, some great little dramatic flourishes to make you feel like it's a speech that's being delivered in the Senate. You know, he talks about the reactions that he gets from Antony or other people, and he addresses people by name in this speech. So what is he trying to achieve with the second half of this Philippic after he's addressed Antony's arguments?
Yeah, absolutely. The largest part of the speech is, in fact, his attack on Antony. And that's probably why it's become so popular today. I think the fact that the second Philippic wasn't delivered may have allowed Cicero to indulge further in his criticism of Antony than he could have done in a spoken oration.
Yes, probably.
Cicero is known for his biting humour. There are certain commonplaces that he uses throughout all of his speeches, which really throw a lot of mud at the personal and political careers. So there are typical charges that come up: sexual misbehavior, appearance or dress, gluttony and drunkenness, greed, avarice, hypocrisy. All of these charges we can trace throughout all of Cicero's speeches. But we get an explosion of all of them in the Philippics. And so Antony comes under attack more than any other of Cicero's opponents. And as I said, it's probably because of the scathing attack on Antony that the speech still appeals so much to readers today. So the kind of charges are starting at the beginning of Antony's career. He'd inherited a bankruptcy from his father. And Cicero says, oh, you might say you inherited it and it's not your fault. But what Cicero condemns is that Antony still sat in the seats that were reserved for men of wealth. So it's audacity. Number one, how dare you? You were bankrupt. You might say that bankruptcy was your father's fault, but still you sat in the special seats reserved for the wealthy when you weren't allowed to. So it's showing Antony as someone with no sort of regard for the rules and the regulations. But that's really just the starting point, because he then goes into detail about his early sexual adventures, ultimately presenting the young Antony as some kind of toy boy and male prostitute. So he says at one point, you put on the toga of manhood and promptly turned it into the badge of a harlot. And you started out as a common whore. Your shame had a fixed price, he says, and no mean one at that. So because of this bankruptcy charge, it means Antony has to sell his body. Now, what we start seeing, and there's a pattern in this, is that all of these private accusations are also levelling concerns about his ability to lead, his ability to be a statesman, because if you're going to sell your body, what else wouldn't you sell? They're personal scathing attacks, but they've always got a point which is a kind of systematic othering of Antony to isolate and alienate him from the community of the elite. So he doesn't belong. He needs to get out. He doesn't fit the behaviour of the Roman men who would have formed the audience. And this kind of alienation figures throughout the speech in other accusations. So he's not just a man, but a beast, far from behaving with the self-control expected of Rome's ruling elite. He's a drunk, and so on. Elsewhere, he downplays Antony's military reputation and accuses him of cowardice because he didn't follow Caesar into Spain. And he turns round to Antony and says, had so good a gladiator as you retired from business so early. So we also get this idea of Antony as a gladiatorial figure, a man of lower class station, rather than a military man of Rome's upper classes. So as I said, although much of Cicero's attack on Antony operates on the level of personal insults, the political implications are never out of sight, and it paints Antony as unworthy of being a member of Rome's ruling class, society, or even the human species. He just doesn't belong to any of those categories. So the net result is that he's utterly unfit to be a consul or a proconsul, as he was soon to be. There are other gems in there. As you mentioned, he tries to invoke the setting. Now, this is something Cicero does in all of his speeches when he wrote them up for publication. So to preserve the dramatic moment, he would include details of his opponent's reactions or the responses of the crowds or details about the scene and the setting in which the speech took place. So this is part of what Cicero generally does, but he does the same in the second Philippic to reinforce this menacing impression that he's built up of Antony. He includes frequent allusions to the physical setting of the day. So at one point he asks Antony, why is the Senate surrounded by a circle of armed men? Or why do your henchmen hear me with their swords in hand? And he complains that he's bringing into the forum the most barbarous of men. So he tries to create a setting that reinforces the message of the second Philippic. It's all fictional, but it all works and hangs together. He also speaks to Antony's reactions, or sometimes his lack of ability to reply to Cicero, to create the impression that he has an invincible case against him. So at one point he takes Antony to task for having taken resort in the arms of his mistress, and Cicero imagines the expression on his face and asks, what's the matter? Am I speaking falsely? How miserable is it not to be able to deny a fact when it is disgraceful to confess? But I think one of my favourite moments is when Cicero brings up Antony's behaviour at the Lupercalia festival. This was an annual event held in February with a whole set of bizarre rituals, which we think were to do with fertility, the beginning of spring, the purification, but they were all conducted in a very carnivalesque way. So as one of the priests on the board of the Luperci, Antony was very involved in this event, and the costume was essentially just an apron or a thong, something very small, made from the skin of a sacrificial goat. So Antony wasn't wearing very much at all. In fact, he was largely naked except for this apron that he had in front of his essentials. But also on this occasion, he'd offered Caesar the crown. We call it the crown. It was more like a Hellenistic diadem, which was more symbolically a crown. So Cicero prefaces his highly vivid account of this event by imagining Antony's face. And again, this goes back to the point of how he invokes the setting and Antony's behaviour. He doesn't disguise it, members of Senate. His agitation is evident. He's sweating and turning pale. And then he adds, as long as he doesn't do what he did in the colonnade of Minucius, which is just to throw in an extra dig about the time Antony had vomited in public while serving as an official capacity as a master of the horse. Cicero tells us it was a hangover from a wedding the day before. It could have been anything, but it becomes one of Cicero's favourite jokes about Antony of all time. This is the epitome of why he is unfit for public office. So he really plays on all of these things, imagining that Antony is there, listening and reacting in horror, shame, embarrassment, really to reinforce the reaction that Cicero wants his audience to have to these words as well. And there are other ways he invokes the setting. He constantly addresses his imagined audience, the fellow senators, or he asks them for a kind hearing. He really cleverly makes sure not to include any anachronisms, anything that had happened after the date of the 19th of September. So the overall effect is one of realism. I think we're quite literally transported into the fictional setting along with Cicero. You can see Antony's reaction. You can see the soldiers standing around. You can see the responses that Cicero's speech is having. It really comes to life.
There's a couple of times where I can almost imagine him writing in, you know, pause for laughter or something like that.
Yes.
He practically does do that. And I gather that if he did deliver this Philippic in front of Antony, he probably wouldn't have left the Senate alive. He probably wouldn't have gotten through the entire speech. It is quite a lengthy speech. He had a lot to say, and none of it was particularly nice. It would have been a very patient Antony to sit through all of that. It's very effective, though, I guess, when you're reading it after the event, and this is essentially a summary of everything that I have against Antony to distribute in pamphlet form.
You could usefully compare it in that regard to some of Cicero's other political speeches, the speeches against Catiline. They are notably lacking in the kind of invective that we see here. Now, invective is a modern term used by scholars to describe the kind of abuse that features in any genre of literature. But we use it in terms of Cicero's speeches to talk about these scandalous accusations, the humour that is generated. And when Cicero is delivering speeches in the midst of the Catilinarian crisis, he avoids them. It's too much of a crisis point. The fact that he didn't deliver this probably allowed him to indulge in them a lot more. And as you say, if those soldiers were there with their swords in hand, Cicero would not have left the building.
So when Antony leaves Rome, does the intention of the Philippics change, or does Cicero vary what he's trying to achieve out of them?
Yes. The moment Antony leaves Rome, it gives Cicero the opportunity to start his attack proper. But Cicero had actually planned not to speak in the Senate until the 1st of January 43 BC. This is when the new consuls were going to assume their roles, because up until the end of December, anything he says in the Senate is against the consul of Rome. That's Antony's official position in 44 BC. But Cicero felt compelled to speak on the 20th of December, so he speaks a little bit earlier than planned when a vital piece of news reached Rome. Antony had left Rome in order to take up the province of Transalpine Gaul. Before he did so, he made a transfer of the provinces. But there were many who were contesting the legality of that move, because according to Caesar's acts, the amnesty agreement that was in place to secure them, the governor of that province was going to be Decimus Brutus. And Decimus Brutus was already in Gaul. So the news arrived at Rome that Decimus Brutus had declared he was not going to hand over his province to Antony without a fight. And so Cicero decides to address the Senate. It happened that the tribunes had convened a meeting of the Senate that day to discuss security measures for the new year. But Cicero used this opportunity to speak on the development, and he launched another determined and ruthless attack against Antony in two speeches, actually. The third Philippic is one to the Senate, urging them to resist Antony, and another to the people, repeating the Senate's debates and decrees. And that's the fourth Philippic. So the fight has started a little bit earlier than Cicero had planned, but the gloves come off on the 20th of December, and Cicero stakes out his position, and he is siding with Decimus Brutus, and he wants to lead a fight against Antony.
And as the Philippics gain pace, is he varying the things that he's asking the Senate for? I guess he's adjusting to the time, the ways that things are developing on the various battlefields, isn't he? So he's talking in favour of Octavian, saying that the Senate should support him. He's talking in favour of Brutus and Cassius. And all the time he's coming back to the denouncement of Mark Antony, just in case they're forgetting it every time. I feel it's a bit like Cato saying at the end of every one of his speeches, Carthage must be destroyed. It's P.S. Antony still needs to be denounced and we don't like him, just at the end of every speech.
You touch on something really important here, because Cicero was in an unusual position in that he was a wise ex-consul of Rome. He had authority, but he couldn't actually initiate action. He had to wait until a Senate debate occurred on which he could add his rejoinder, as you say, Antony must be taken down, he must be denounced. We know roughly about how a senatorial meeting could have taken place. And a consul would speak, and then he would invite ex-consuls to speak as well in turn on a set proposal. So what we get Cicero doing is not adding his any other business at the end, but he will turn every occasion into an opportunity to reiterate his key theme, that Antony should be declared a national enemy. So he has no initiative to start these discussions, but what he can do is hijack discussions to bring it back round to his central thesis. And the Philippics really include a wide array of oratorical situations. Sometimes it's a eulogy for one of his friends who dies on an embassy to Antony of natural causes, but Cicero proposes that a statue be honoured because, of course, he's died in the fight against Antony. Or he will speak on military commands for Brutus and Cassius fighting over in the east. So there are a wide variety of situations, but this reflects the nature of Cicero's position in 44 going on to 43 BC. He's a man who can't initiate discussion, but he can bring his own agenda into the discussions that are on the table.
So how persuasive was he then in swaying the Senate against Antony? I guess we've only really got his word to go by on this, but he is successful at getting a few motions passed, if not always against Antony, then in the favour of those fighting against Antony.
Yeah, I mean, they were certainly persuasive insofar as history has often accepted Cicero's damning characterisation of Mark Antony. And as you say, a lot of his speeches led to the outcome that Cicero desired. I think only about 8 of the 14 Philippics that we possess formulate specific proposals. Others, as we've seen, were reports to the people or Cicero's imaginary speech. Mm. And of these, the ones in which he's honouring people who are fighting against Antony are successful. So Philippic 3, he gets Decimus Brutus confirmed in his positions and the resistance is honoured. He wants Octavian to be awarded certain rights that will allow him to fight against Antony, and that's all passed. But what's really striking in the corpus is that any time that Cicero calls for a strict war policy is unsuccessful. So for a long time, the Senate thought that there could be a chance of negotiation with Antony. So the fifth Philippic, for example, is on the debate about whether an embassy should be sent to Antony. And Cicero's advice is no, we need to fight now. Negotiations with Antony are impossible. Yet this is unsuccessful. So Cicero's hard line is always resisted. Even when we get to the 14th speech, the final speech in the collection, this is successful insofar as Cicero proposes honours again for people who have fought against Antony and actually defeated Antony at the Battle of the Forum Gallorum. but he's still not declared a hostis until later. So the final speech in the collection is the 14th Philippic on the 21st of April, but it was actually events on the battlefield that determined what happened next, because when Cicero delivered the 14th Philippic, Antony was still to suffer his second defeat at Mutina. So it was Antony's defeat, his continued aggression, that led him to be declared a national enemy, as he finally was on the 26th of April. But Cicero didn't realise the end game in the collection of speeches that we have. And I should add at this point as well, there were more Philippics than those that Cicero published in the corpus. So later readers referred to a 16th Philippic or a 17th Philippic. But we don't know what those speeches contained.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So what we get is a very consciously edited collection to present a specific and general idea of Cicero leading the resistance against Mark Antony. And it deliberately, it seems, closes on a high point for Cicero, where Antony has been defeated and he's proposing honours. So it looks like Cicero has achieved his ultimate goal, but actually there's a lot to play out yet. And so Cicero continued speaking, but we don't know what he said.
So how effective were they when it came to Mark Antony? He very much made himself an enemy here. I feel that if he stopped at the first Philippic, he and Antony might have still been on each other's Saturnalia card list at the end of the year. But after that, it's probably an end of the romance between them, isn't it?
It's a really difficult one, because you could say that about a lot of people that Cicero came into conflict with in his lifetime. These political friendships have their counterpart in political enmities, inimicitiae. And Cicero has a lot of enemies. But throughout his lifetime, we see him supporting people that he had previously viciously hated. So, for example, in the context of the Philippics, Cicero supports a certain Lucius Calpurnius Piso, who had been Caesar's father-in-law. And this Piso had spoken out against Antony, had really been the only person to oppose him before Cicero came back on the scene. And so Cicero gives him due credit, speaks of him in warm terms. Yet this Piso was also the recipient of a scathing attack of Cicero's earlier in his career, because Piso had done very little to protect Cicero at the time of his exile. So Cicero had a habit of forming enemies who he could later either defend in court or speak warmly about, as the example of Piso shows. So some scholars might be inclined to think that nothing was irreversible, that after the first and second Philippic, maybe Cicero and Antony could have made amends. But I think that Cicero knew when he put that second Philippic out, that was going to be the deal breaker for good. Yeah. And he could have stopped there. But by that point, he'd done the damage. I don't think there was any coming back from that second Philippic. Because of the particular circumstance of the struggle, Cicero wanted his version of events on the record, because he had to prove that he was doing what was morally correct or politically necessary. He needed to defend his name. He'd probably learnt from Demosthenes that even if you failed, you could still have a great reputation by presenting yourself in a certain way, which would also suggest that Cicero was behind the publication of the corpus as a whole.
Very good. Do you have any Philippic highlights that you'd like to take us out with?
The Philippics are full of highlights. The rhetoric Cicero uses is so stark that it's become an example of all time of what scholars have called the rhetoric of crisis. He creates a very disjunctive mode, and everything is black or white, so it's either all or nothing. So we discussed the third and fourth Philippic, in which Cicero really started the fight against Antony. But the strategy is developed further in the fifth Philippic, where he really pushes his agenda to have Antony denounced as a public enemy. One of the things that we need to bear in mind is that there were many in the Senate who actually didn't want to go to civil war. They were still reeling from the civil war between Pompey and Caesar. And also, Antony still had some supporters in the Senate. It's hard to believe from Cicero's speeches, but there were people who supported Antony as well. And so because of this, Cicero is continually pushing for Antony to be declared a public enemy. In the fifth Philippic, one of the ideas on the table was that a peace proposal should be sent to Antony first. So an embassy should go out and try to negotiate with him. And early on in the speech is a wonderful example of Cicero's rhetoric of crisis. And he presses his favourite themes of liberty versus tyranny, declaring it's all or nothing. So it's not necessarily the best example of all of the Philippics, but it really encapsulates what Cicero tries to do. He addresses the Senate and he says, what is being decided is this: whether Mark Antony be given the means of crushing the Republic, massacring decent men, parceling out the city, bestowing lands on his fellow robbers, and of enslaving the Roman people, or whether none of this is to be placed within his power. He turns to the Senate and says, do you hesitate what to do? So he's really saying it's all or nothing. It's liberty or tyranny. It's slavery or freedom. And this is what scholars have termed the disjunctive mode. But Antony is presented as one of the most foul and barbarous of all enemies. He's not just a citizen of Rome. He cannot be a citizen of Rome anymore, in fact. He's worse than Hannibal, Rome's greatest enemy. At one point in the Fifth Philippic, he turns round to the Senate and he says, what hostile act did Hannibal commit, which Antonius has not committed, or is not committing, or is not putting in hand and planning? So Hannibal was still a figure of terror and fascination to the Romans. He was their greatest enemy of all times. There's a Latin expression that Cicero uses in one of his other works, the expression Hannibal ad portas, meaning Hannibal is at the gates. And it was used to invoke fear, anxiety, or even as a warning to naughty children. But this expression, Hannibal is at the gates, conjures up the image of the intense fear that still surrounded the figure of Hannibal. And now Cicero uses it to make it very clear that Antony is even worse than Hannibal. So he's not a citizen of Rome. He's worse than their greatest enemy of all times.
Antonius et portus.
Yes. He could have changed it here. He missed out on a trick.
That was Dr. Catherine Tempest, reader in Classics and Ancient History at the University of Roehampton, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. They are very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Catherine is at Catherine Tempest. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, Antony takes the fight north and moves towards the city of Mutina. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.